Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. On February 15, 1947, Glenn Chambers boarded a plane bound for Quito, Ecuador, to begin his ministry in missionary broadcasting. He never arrived. In a horrible moment, the plane carrying Chambers crashed into a mountain peak and spiraled downward. Later, it was learned that before leaving Miami Airport, Chambers wanted to write his mother a letter. All he could find for stationery was a page of advertising on which was written the single word, "Why?" Around that word, he hastily scribbled a final note to his mother. After Chambers' mother learned of her son's death, his letter arrived in the mail. She opened the envelope, took out the paper, and unfolded it. Staring her in the face was the question, "Why?" We have studied much about the sovereignty of God in the book of Daniel, for this is one of the grand themes of this book. God's sovereign will often leave us with the question, why? We know that God is in control, but why does he allow evil to flourish? Why do God's people suffer? We cannot hope to answer all of the why questions you might have today. Or I might have. Many are not even answerable until eternity, when we can see things from God's perspective. However, Daniel 11 does address the question of evil in this world from the perspective of God's sovereign purpose. We continue our study by looking at Daniel 11, verses 21 to 35. This is the prophecy of one of the most evil men to persecute Israel in ancient times. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes. And God gave Daniel this prophecy about him 400 years before he lived. Looking at prophecy is like looking at snapshots in a photo album. The pictures are generally in sequence, but gaps of time exist between the snapshots. Each shot is a still picture of something happening in a short period of time. Perhaps it's more like the movie mode on a digital camera, a short burst of action captured in a moment of time. To carry the analogy further, we can see in Daniel 11 that he is using a zoom lens to capture the pictures. He begins with a wide-angle look at the entire period of history. Then he zooms progressively closer to look at elements of this terrible time in Israel's history. There are four snapshots of evil that I would like us to see in Daniel 11, 21 to 35. First, we look through the wide-angle lens. And the principle is this: evil wins, but only for a time. Evil wins, but only for a time. Verses 21 to 24. In his place, A despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. The overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. Verse 21. The despicable ruler in this verse is Antiochus IV. He was the brother of Seleucus IV, the king predicted in verse 20. Antiochus IV had been held hostage in Rome, but was on his way back to Syria when he learned of his brother's death. The son and rightful heir to the throne of Syria was a young man named Demetrius. But Antiochus was determined that his nephew would not claim the throne, so he used bribery and flattery to curry the favor of the authorities and have himself placed on the throne of Syria, thus fulfilling what God told Daniel many, many years earlier when he said, "On whom the honor of kingship had not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue." Antiochus called himself Epiphanes, which means the illustrious one, and he combined that title with the word God, so that his title became Illustrious God. This title was put on coins minted in his honor, and he has been known ever since as Antiochus Epiphanes. However, the people of Israel in the streets of the cities had another name for Antiochus. They called him Antiochus Epimenes, which means Antiochus the madman. To the Jews, he was the crazy one, the loony one. Daniel called him the despicable or contemptible king in verse 21. Verses 22 to 24. The prince of the covenant would be the high priest of Israel. Onias III was the high priest when Antiochus came to power. Antiochus detained Onias and then replaced him with Jason his brother, who paid a large sum of money to be made high priest in place of Onias. Jason also offered to emphasize Greek culture in Jerusalem and paganize the religious practices of the Jews. A gymnasium was built in which Jews began to follow the Greek practice of competing in the nude. 3 years later, Menelaus, another brother, offered Antiochus a larger bribe and replaced Jason as high priest. Menelaus paid for his bribe with the golden utensils of the temple in Jerusalem. Onias, the rightful high priest, was so angry that he protested, and Menelaus had him murdered to protect his position. Antiochus also engaged in his first war with Egypt. He was able to defeat the much larger Egyptian army by deception. The king of Egypt was Ptolemy VI. His name was Philometor. Some of the members of his royal court conspired against him so that Antiochus defeated his large and well-equipped army, and Philometor was taken captive. His brother, Physcon, was installed as king of Egypt in his place. Then Antiochus conspired with Philometor to defeat Physcon and put Philometor back on the throne of Egypt in place of his brother, but as an ally of Antiochus. This allowed Antiochus to take much plunder from the Egyptian empire, just as verse 24 predicted 400 years earlier. Yet God is sovereign. Notice how the section ends. He will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time, only for a time. God is in charge. God sets the limits for evil in this world. When his time was up, God made sure that he was defeated by the Egyptians, as we shall see in the ensuing close-ups of this war. Justice is in the hands of God, not men. Evil wins, but only for a time. That's a look at history through the wide-angle lens. Now we zoom in and take a closer look. Zoom one, and here's the principle. Evil battles evil, so they both lose. Verses 25 to 28. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war. But he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. Those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table. But it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. What does the face of evil look like? Chuck Colson raised that question in his book, How Now Shall We Then Live? Then he tells a story about speaking in a South Carolina women's prison. He had learned that Susan Smith had signed up to hear him speak in the prison. Smith is the woman who drowned her two small sons because the man she dated hinted that he would not marry her because of the boys. Chuck Colson says he scanned the audience, looking for her face as he spoke. He couldn't pick her out in the audience at all. After the meeting, he asked the director whether Smith had attended. "Oh, sure," he replied. "She was in the front row staring at you the whole time." Then Colson added this telling comment. "The face of evil is frighteningly ordinary." The more we study history, the more we see the people of today in the faces of yesterday. People, evil people, carry out evil plans today just as they did in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes. But evil people look very ordinary. As we zoom in, we see the evil plans in more vivid detail. Verses 25 and 26 read, "The king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. Those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain." Daniel predicted with great precision the war between Egypt and Syria that ended in the defeat of Philometor, who was taken captive by Antiochus through the intrigues of his royal court. Philometor's brother Physcon sat on the throne of Egypt instead. Now look at verse 27. "As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time." So we're given a prophetic insight here that is incredible. The two kings, the victorious Antiochus and the defeated Philometor, sat down to work out a treaty together. Antiochus helped Philometor defeat his brother Physcon and regain the throne of Egypt. At the banqueting table, they worked out their alliance, just as Daniel had predicted 400 years earlier. Supposedly, they were now allies, but both men were filled with evil intentions. They spoke lies to each other in the treaty. Antiochus fully intended to conquer Egypt and rule over Philometor. Philometor pretended to be Antiochus's ally until he could work out an arrangement with his brother Physcon. Then Philometor and Physcon joined forces to defeat Antiochus. God predicted that this alliance would not succeed. Once again, notice the point God makes in verse 27. The end is still to come at the appointed time. God's in charge, not the kings of Egypt and Syria, or the presidents and dictators of today. They thought they were masters of their own destiny, but God was moving events according to his perfect timetable. God was orchestrating the circumstances, deceptions, and intrigues of evil and devious rulers so that God's plan would play out in human history even as they made their plans. God uses evil against evil. Human history operates within the boundaries set by God. Evil battles evil, so they both lose in God's appointed time. Let's zoom in to another level. Zoom 2. Evil attacks God's people, for evil hates God's holiness. That's the principle. Evil attacks God's people, for evil hates God's holiness. 29 to 31. At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this last time it will not turn out the way it did before. For ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action, so he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. So these verses take a closer picture of the events of December 168 BC, when Antiochus desecrated the temple of Jerusalem. Notice that these evil events take place at the appointed time. God is in control, not Antiochus. At the appointed time, Antiochus led another military campaign against Egypt. He had learned that Philometor and Physcon had joined forces against him, so he invaded the land in 168 BC. Only this time, he was not successful. Verse 30. The prophecy about the ships of Kittim was fulfilled by the Roman navy under the leadership of Pompilius Laenas. Rome had become concerned about Antiochus, so Pompilius Laenas met Antiochus outside of Alexandria, Egypt, and told him to leave Egypt immediately. Antiochus stalled for time, so Laenas drew a circle in the sand around where he was standing and told Antiochus to decide to leave Egypt or fight Rome before he stepped outside the circle. Antiochus, fearful of Rome's power, chose to leave Egypt, but he did so in great anger. Antiochus took out his frustration on Jerusalem. Daniel predicted that he would become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action, so he would come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Antiochus became enraged at the Holy Covenant, that is, God's people in Israel, on his way back to Syria. Daniel writes in verse 31, "Forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation." Antiochus was a bitter man, and he chose to vent his bitterness on the people of Israel. When evil men crash into God's boundaries, that is, God's limitations, they become even more evil. Antiochus forced Jews to take part in a drunken orgy to the Greek god Bacchus, the god of wine. He stopped the sacrifices in the temple and ordered the Old Testament scriptures to be destroyed. Any Jews who tried to worship God or read the Word of God, practice circumcision, or celebrate any Sabbath were executed. Thousands were killed across the land of Israel. A pagan altar was set up in the temple, and a pig was sacrificed on the altar. The temple was used to worship Zeus by order of Antiochus. This is the abomination of desolation predicted by Daniel 400 years earlier. Evil attacks God's people because evil hates God's holiness. The final picture from this prophetic photo album zooms in on the response of a few Jewish patriots who stood up for God's holiness and paid a huge price for their commitment in verses 32 to 35. So this is Zoom 3. And the principle is, evil attacks require a holy response. Evil attacks require a holy response. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness, those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. Yet they will fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. Now, when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end, because it is still to come at the appointed time. So many Jews chose to follow Antiochus for financial benefit. They knew that they would succeed economically by siding with Antiochus. But there were a few Jews who stayed true to God and his holy covenant with Israel. These are the people who know their God and display strength and action in verse 32. It's a great statement of biblical conviction. We need the same kind of biblical conviction whenever we face evil today. These faithful followers of God suffer dearly for the cause of God's holiness. These verses predicted the coming of the Maccabees 400 years before these heroes of Israel arrived on the scene. Verse 33 reads, "Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. Yet they will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder, for many days." It all started in the village of Modin. Mattathias was the godly priest in that village. A representative of Menelaus, the high priest in Jerusalem, came to offer a pig on the altar. Mattathias took out a knife and killed the representative. He destroyed the altar and then called on all those who loved God to flee with him into the mountains, leaving their possessions behind. "Follow me," he shouted, "everyone who is zealous for the law and strives to maintain the covenant." You can read these accounts in the books of the Maccabees. Mattathias and his five sons, John, Simon, Judas, Eleazar, and Jonathan, led the rebellion. The slogan of the Jewish fighters as they went into battle was, "Who is like you among the gods, O Lord?" This was a Hebrew acrostic that spelled out Maccabee. Many of the early patriots died in the first battles because the Greeks would attack on the Sabbath when they knew that the Jews would not fight back. So, the Maccabees changed their convictions and agreed to fight on the Sabbath for the sake of the holiness of God. Not long after, Mattathias died and entrusted the leadership of the movement to his five sons. It was Judah who led the forces to several major victories, even though the Greek armies vastly outnumbered them. Judah was given the nickname the Hammer for his great military exploits against the much better equipped Greek armies. Three times Judah defeated the armies of Antiochus. The last time they fought on foot against Antiochus's elite troops who were riding elephants. Eleazar, one of the five sons, was crushed to death when he stabbed a charging elephant and it fell on top of him. His heroism inspired the others to attack the enemy and defeat them. Look at verses 34 and 35. Now, when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. As they began to have success against Antiochus, some Jews joined the movement out of hypocrisy, because the Maccabees would kill Jews who sided with the enemy. The Maccabees were zealous in purifying the people. They would preach God's holiness in the synagogues and fight for God's holiness in battle. Many in the movement became known as the Hasidim, and some of them became the Pharisees of Jesus' day. There was no compromise, and their zeal demanded total commitment. Unfortunately, the zeal degenerated by the time of Christ into legalism. The Pharisees transformed the holy zeal of the Hasidim into something picky and petty. No longer concerned with God's holiness, they became consumed with proving man's holiness. And this, my friends, is always the nature of legalism and legalistic zeal. To retain a holy zeal without slipping into a vicious legalism is a difficult balance to maintain. But these zealous leaders eventually won a great victory and took over the city of Jerusalem. On December 164 BC, the 25th of Kislev, Judas Maccabee purified the temple and reinstated the sacrifices. The celebration of Hanukkah lasts 8 days to celebrate this great event in Jewish history. Each night of Hanukkah, after the candles are lit, the family sings a song entitled Rock of Ages, written by a Jew in the 13th century. The song celebrates the victories God has given the nation of Israel down through the centuries of her history. It is a song of faith in God's ability to defeat God's enemies. Evil attacks require a holy response. There are times when Christians are called on to stand up for the holiness of God. No compromise, total commitment. Would you be ready? Would I? I like the words of the Puritan preacher Jonathan Edwards, who said, "Resolved that all men should live for the glory of God. Resolved, second, that whether others do or not, I will." What do you do when you are in a place you do not want to be, but you know that you are there by God's appointment? This is the great question of Daniel. He spent his whole life serving God where he did not want to be. Ripped away from his homeland and his family while still a teenager and forced to grow up in a pagan city. He served 5 political administrations through 3 brutal dynasties. For 65 years, Daniel carried out his responsibilities, even when his boss, the king, continued to destroy his homeland and his people. During all this time, he remained faithful to God above the king, and demonstrated loyalty to God even when his life was threatened. God may lead us to that point of testing, my friends. We must resolve to stand up for God in the place of no return. our commitment must be a holy commitment. The preeminence of God is always first in our hearts and minds and lives. In 1519, Cortes led a Spanish expedition to Mexico. Once they landed, he burned the ships so the men could not be tempted to return to Spain when the going got tough. Stephen Curtis Chapman applied that same principle to our spiritual lives in a song whose lyrics read, "Burn the ships, we're here to stay. There's no way we could go back now that we've come this far by faith. Burn the ships, we've passed the point of no return. Our life is here, so let the ships burn." So we've seen God's sovereign will in Daniel 11. God allowed evil to flourish, but only for a time. God brought justice to these evil men at the appointed time. God controls even the free choices of evil men so that they freely choose to wage war at the appointed time. Now, we come to verse 35, and we realize that God's sovereign will includes suffering in the cause of holiness. Listen to the words of verse 35 once again. "Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time." God allows his faithful people to suffer and die until the end that will come at the appointed time. Judas Maccabeus died in the Battle of Mount Azotus a few years after his victory at Jerusalem. Israel will continue to suffer until that day comes when Messiah returns to establish his kingdom on this earth. Why does God allow such suffering? Why? There's our question again. Why? A partial answer is found in this verse. God allows suffering and struggle in order to refine, purge, and purify his people. That message is true not just for Israel, but for us as well. You may be going through one of those rough times in your life right now. You are in a place you do not want to be, facing struggles you do not want to face, but you know you are there by God's appointed time, God's appointment. My friends, please understand this truth. God's sovereign will achieves God's purifying purpose. God is still in the purifying business today, because it is the business of making us into saints. You are becoming the saint God wants you to be through the purifying process God has designed for you. It is his appointment for you. You say, "Well, Dave, look, I've had enough purifying. I don't aspire to sainthood. Enough is enough." My friends, I don't know God's will for your life, but I know he knows what he is purifying you for, and God knows when enough is enough. I love the quote by John Wesley, who said, "Give me 100 men who hate nothing but sin and love God with all their hearts, and I will shake the world for Christ." God is looking to purify men and women for his global mission today. Will you be one of them? Are you, am I, up for it?